Hi. Good morning, everyone. It's really a pleasure to be here and to learn Torah with everyone this morning. The title of the shiur, what we're going to discuss today, is When Good Kings Go Bad, the cautionary tale of Shlomo HaMelech. I've always thought that Shlomo HaMelech was a fascinating character. On one hand, when we think about his reign, he's perhaps one of the most successful kings that we've had in perhaps Jewish history. We know that under his reign, the borders of Eretz Yisrael expand. We know that he brings wealth, he brings trade, he creates international agreements with other kingdoms. We know that there's almost this utopian peace that takes place during his time period. We'll get to it at the end, but it's actually the last couple of sources we see that Shlomo's kingdom is actually described, bring the quote, right at the end. His kingdom is described as one where everyone in, if you look right at the end, in source 21, everyone is sitting by Yeshev Yehuda, Yisrael Betach, Ish Tachat Gefno, Betachat Teinato. Everyone is sitting under their fig tree. There's parallels to that in Sefer Micha, when I think about the ultimate messianic age. It's really a utopian age. We know the famous story of Malkat Shva coming to visit Shlomo HaMelech, coming to hear about his wisdom, almost the ultimate expression of being Or LeGoyim, where she's coming to hear about it and she sees all the tzedek and mishpat that his kingdom is doing. So on one hand, tremendous, amazing things being accomplished by Shlomo HaMelech. At the same time, there's a much darker side, right? We all know how the story ends with his foreign wives, with the Avodah Zarah. In the next generation, we even see that there's a civil war, right? And his kingdom is kind of split in half between his son Rehavam and also between Yerovam. So what exactly happens? How do we see that Shlomo goes again from being this tremendous, successful, perhaps, at least as the way it's painted in Sefer Melachim, tremendous, successful king, to suddenly the kingdom being torn apart, that almost his sins destroying it from within? So I thought what we do today is we try to look at the different stories of Shlomo, try to figure out exactly what happened. On one hand, this amazing kingdom, and then suddenly everything switched and it kind of went all the way up and then all the way down? Or perhaps was there a more gradual process? Could we kind of look at the different incidents that take place in Shlomo's life and see that perhaps many of them had a darker side to them, that perhaps we could have almost even have seen this coming, but almost to look at where exactly are the successes and the failures from Shlomo's kingdom really coming from? I think it's interesting to discuss this coming right off of Purim. So as we know, especially in the story of the Megillah, we have many different types of leaders, where you think about Ahasuerus or Haman or Mordechai and Esther and how they deal with power, how they deal with affluence, how they deal with manipulation. But I think, again, different styles of kingdom or how exactly we rule, how we deal with different challenges are things that we can see both in the Megillah and also here, going back to the original story here of Shlomo HaMelech. So if we look at kind of the source sheet over here, and I'll explain exactly how we're going to do this. On one hand, many of these ideas that we'll share today come from many different kind of Tanakh scholars. I gave you in the back almost a further reading list if you want to examine this a little bit further. Rav Alex Israel wrote an excellent book on Sefer Melachim called Book of Kings Torn in Two, so I highly recommend that as well. And if you look, basically, as I said before, what we're going to try to do today is look through the different incidents that take place in Shlomo's life. So if we go to the first page, major chart, and this chart is here based loosely off of Alex Israel's different incidents or different charts that he has in his book. And I thought we'd just kind of go through Shlomo's life, and this is kind of a overview over here by Gadol, and then we'll kind of go through the different incidents and see if we can kind of figure out what exactly has been happening in Shlomo's kingdom. Where exactly is the point of the downfall? So if we look over here, the way that Shlomo's kingdom starts off, we have the rise of an empire in Perimel. This is in Sefer Melachim. Shlomo marries Bat Paro. God appears to Shlomo in Givon, and Shlomo requests wisdom. We have the famous story of the two zonot who come, right, and the baby being split in two, and Shlomo's wisdom. Then we see that Shlomo kind of assembles a cabinet. We then are told in Parakeh of his power, his wealth, his wisdom. He starts to create treaties with Hiram Melchzor up north. We also then start to see forced labor, which is also going to be a theme in Shlomo's kingdom. Then we have perhaps what Shlomo HaMelech is most famous for, which is building the Beit HaMikdash. But we're also told about his building of the palace, his own palace, his dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, and there's a beautiful tefillah that Shlomo has saying that he wants us to be a place that everyone can come and pray, both Jews and non-Jews. It then continues in Perek Tet, throughout Perek Yud Bet, where God appears to Shlomo again, and he warns him that everything, that the peace and the success and the utopia kind of exists, will only continue if he continues to follow in God's ways. We then see again more power, wealth, and wisdom, people bringing tributes when they come to hear wisdom from Shlomo, more forced labor, negotiations with Hiram, not everything is going so smoothly, is accumulation of more gold and horses. And then we have the famous visit of Malkat Sheva, where she comes and sees the tzedek u'mishpat that Shlomo's kingdom is hopefully expressing. We then in Perek Yud Aleph are told almost here of all of Shlomo's sins, the multiple wives, the Avodah Zarah. God rebukes Shlomo, tells him that his kingdom is going to be torn away. All of a sudden we're told about enemies, not just internal enemies where we see kind of a rebellion almost starting or kind of underpinnings of it, but also external enemies seem to be attacking in different areas around Shlomo's kingdom. Shlomo passes away, and then Perek Yud Bet, we see the kingdom is in fact torn in two. So if I would ask you, if we had to outline where exactly the point of the downfall is, and I've done this different times with my students and had, you know, different reactions, where would we say that the kingdom starts to decline? When does everything kind of take a downwards turn? Any thoughts? I know it's a big crowd. We'll see if we can make this slightly interactive. Any thoughts? If you would have to pinpoint, where is the downfall of Shlomo's kingdom? Yeah. Okay. So, interesting. So, on one hand, perhaps there isn't, you know, this downfall at the end, but even at the beginning, right, you're saying that already kind of marrying Bat Paro is almost the beginning of the end. Okay, interesting. Other thoughts? I don't think she's given, she actually don't think she's given a name in the text, but it does say we're going to look at that source in a minute when we'll see. Yeah. Yeah. Right. And we'll see kind of what's confusing with Shlomo is why he kind of goes against that, right? We'll see, especially Arshat HaMelech and what he's told not to. But again, so one approach could be maybe at the beginning, maybe at the beginning, with marrying Bat Paro is a problem. Maybe at the end, when he starts taking on the multiple wives, that's when things fall apart. Yeah. Yeah. Very nice. So almost kind of like once he's achieved the Beit HaMikdash, once he's done things that are positive, kind of when he has no more things to accomplish, that's when things start to fall apart a little bit. So interesting. That could also be a different approach. Anyone else? Any other thoughts? Yeah. Okay, interesting. And we're going to look at that also, and we'll see that forced labor actually comes at different times. And something that's very surprising about Shlomo HaMelech, right, and something that's surprising almost or disturbing, thinking about the Beit HaMikdash or different things like that, that who was the Beit HaMikdash, on whose backs was the Beit HaMikdash kind of built, right? So kind of also kind of a darker side to different things. So great. So for sure, right? And I think that's something that we're going to see as we bring it together, that on one hand, what is expected of a king who is trying to do the best thing that he can do in his time period to lead his people and to make sure they're living in a time of peace and prosperity. But at the same time, you know, how does he balance that with fulfilling, let's say, Dvar Hashem and doing, let's say, his religious duties? And we're going to see, I think, that sometimes these things might come into conflict. And it's not just Shlomo. We'll see this also a little bit later on. People who are familiar with the story of Ahav also is someone who makes treaties with different people. Again, someone who is, you know, I would say not probably one of the positive kings when it comes to the different kings that we see in Tanakh. But again, perhaps a more charitable read when it comes to certain things that he does could be that trying to do the best thing to provide peace and prosperity for one's people. So coming back to Shlomo, and just to kind of bring up the different opinions that we heard, if we would try to highlight where exactly Shlomo's downfall takes place, I think we heard a few different approaches, which we're going to see reflected in different kind of Tanakh scholars, different approaches. So on one hand, the most kind of clear approach or clear parallel, which we'll see in a minute, seems to be between Perek Gimel and Perek Yud Aleph. In Perek Gimel, we see kind of, again, we'll see this in a second, that very positive things, while in Perek Yud Aleph, all of a sudden we see the multiple wives, we see God rebuking Shlomo, we see kind of everything kind of coming apart. That seems to be, at least the way Tanakh seems to be painting it on one hand, the starkest contrast. Everything is amazing. Perek Gimel is, you know, great. Everything is starting up. Once we get to Perek Yud Aleph, everything starts to crash and burn. Another approach could be similar to what a few people said, perhaps not Perek Yudalef, but perhaps a little bit earlier in Perek Tet. Rav Alex Israel talks about this a little bit in his book, that it could be perhaps we see that, you know, God is appearing to Shlomo again. He's warning him. After that, we start to see kind of, again, the forced labor things start to fall apart a little bit. The only problem with that, and Rav Menachem Livtag talks about this also, that perhaps why is Perek Yudalef a downfall? Because right before Perek Yudalef, when Malkat Shva comes to visit, and she says that she sees with Shlomo's kingdom the ultimate expression of Tzedek U'Mishpat, that this really does seem to be the highlight. So again, it's hard to kind of fit the visit of Malkat Shva into being part of a downfall, so that's another approach. But again, as people said at the beginning, and we'll see this also as we go through it, that again, does it have to be such a stark contrast of we're building everything up, then everything falls apart in Perek Yudalef, or was this utopia perhaps a little bit darker than we originally had thought? Going back to perhaps Perek Yud Gimel, Shlomo marrying Bat Paro, and we'll see this in Midrashim, is also seen as not a very positive thing, and perhaps this is already the beginning of the end. So if you turn the page over, we'll look at these approaches in more detail. So if we think about Perek Gimel and Perek Yudalef being the biggest kind of contrast here, there's a lot of textual parallels between Perek Gimel and Perek Yudalef. Perek Gimel being things are amazing, things are really good, except for the whole Bat Paro part, and Perek Yudalef is everything seems to be falling apart. So Dr. Micha Goodman writes an excellent book on Sefer Devarim, where he talks a lot about kingship and power, and he talks about Shlomo also in this book, and he shows here the kind of stark difference between these two Perekim, and the kind of highlighted connection that we see between them. So for example, in Perek Yud Gimel, we're told that Shlomo loves God, right? We're told, besides from the fact that he's marrying Bat Paro, in Pasuk Gimel it says, Vayahav Shlomo et Hashem alechet bechukot David Aviv, right, that Shlomo loves God. But then immediately in Perek Yud Aleph, we look further down, it says, Vehamel Shlomo ahav nashim nachriyo rabot ve'et Bat Paro. So all of a sudden, again, showing how his love for God has switched to now his love for foreign women, for Bat Paro, a switching of allegiances perhaps. We see in Perek Gimel that he's going after, right, by Yalech, Lechet Bechukot David Aviv, he's going after the practices of his father David. But in Perek Yudalef, we're told, in Pasuk Hey, by Yalech Shlomo Acharei Ashtarot Elokei Tzidonim. Now he's going after foreign gods. So again, this almost switching, this parallel of what's happening to Shlomo over here. What's the switch that seems to be taking place? And the other parallel we see later on in the same Perek and Perek Gimel, before the Beit HaMikdash was built, it was permissible to worship at different bamot, right? At different kind of breakaway shuls, right? But breakaway mizbachot that were all, or altars that were all over Eretz Yisrael. And it says over here that by Yahav Shlomo et Hashem alecha bechukot David Aviv, rak v'amot hu mizbeach u'matir. That in this situation, right, in Perek Gimel, Shlomo is building bamot, he's worshiping bamot, but bamot that are for God. But in Perek Yudalef, we're told, az yivnei Shlomo bama, lechmos shiketz moav, bahar asher al pnei Yushalayim, v'lamolech shiketz bnei amon. Shlomo is now building bamot, but they are not to God, but they are to foreign gods. So again, we see kind of the setup, we'll talk a little about this at the end, of Perek Gimel being Shlomo on a high point, seemingly doing fine religiously, but by Perek Yudalef, everything seems to be crashing and burning, the exact opposite. So the question that we're going to try to figure out is, first of all, was it so clear that it was such a stark contrast, right, going from things being great to things being terrible? Or again, as people pointed out before, perhaps if we look at the different incidents in Shlomo's life, there could be a darker side. And then the question to us is really, what lessons can we take from this? What can we take from Shlomo's character, and what can we take from his kingship? So, turn the page over. We're now on... And before we start, the other thing which I think people mentioned before, which is interesting, is in Sefer Dvarim, if you look in source number 3, we're told about Parshat HaMelech, the list of halachot or laws that kings are supposed to follow. And what's fascinating is that Shlomo's sins are almost as if he took this as a checklist, right? You know, what are the things that the kings are not supposed to do? And this is exactly what Shlomo seems to have done. So again, perhaps showing hubris, perhaps again seeing that, or again, Midrashim talk about the Shlomo thought that, you know, he wouldn't fail in this where other people had fallen. But again, it's just interesting that the fact that the sins that he seems to be doing are ones that are already have been warned against in the Torah. Okay, so let's go through the different kind of, I would say, highlights of Shlomo's kingdom, and we'll try to figure out, you know, exactly, were these so positive up until Perek Yudalef, or perhaps before Perek Yudalef, do they also have kind of a darker turn? So the first one, which people already mentioned, was the marriage to Bat Paro. So this is now on source 4. So we know that Shlomo marries Bat Paro. We're told this right at the beginning of Sefer Melachim Aleph and Perek Gimel. Vaytanen Shlomo to Paro Melech Mitzrayim Veikach et Bat Paro Vayveo El Ir David Ad Kolato Livnot Beito Beit Hashem VeChamot Yerushalayim Saviv. Shlomo marries Bat Paro specifically as a way to perhaps ensure an alliance with Mitzrayim, with Egypt. Pardon? Yes, not out of love. We'll talk about that. He brings her to Ir David, and we'll see later on, he brings her to the palace, and a lot of different buildings that are being built. We'll talk about the Malo, which seems to be, again, like the Milo, that seems to be a building built for Bat Paro that causes some trouble later. But again, Shlomo's marriage to Bat Paro. So one, as people said, right, it doesn't seem to be done out of love. It seems to be done why? Interest, political alliances, this is why it's being done. So on one end, if we want to try to have a more charitable read, right, it could be, this is how things are done, perhaps in this time. If you want to ensure peace for your people, and you don't want Egypt as an enemy, and you want to ensure Egypt, you have some sort of alliance, some sort of treaty, you marry the daughter of the king. I remember a couple of years ago, I went on vacation to Scotland, and all of the history that I remember as I was going through and looking at different museums, it reminded me so much of Sefer Melachim, because, or Ahav, or the different kings, everyone is, everything is about political marriages. How do you make sure that there aren't wars? Who do you marry? Whose daughter? How do you create alliances? So I want to have perhaps a more charitable read for Shlomo. However, on the other side, it's still, again, he's still bringing in someone who's outside the faith, right? Still bringing someone in who's a foreigner to the situation. If you look at source number five, the Gemara does not see us in a positive light at all. The Gemara in Shabbat, Amar Rabbi Huda Amar Shmuel, V'sha'ash Nasa Shlomo et Bat Paro, Yerad Gavriel, V'na'atz Kana Bayam, V'alav Boshir Ton, V'alav Nivne Kerach Gadol Shel Romi. And the Gemara in Masachat Shabbat sees this almost as the moment that Shlomo married Bat Paro. This was the beginning of the end. This started off when, you know, Rome started to be created, which I thought was interesting, that it's not just even the first temple where it was destroyed by Babel. It's only the second temple that's destroyed by Rome. But almost again, this was seen as such almost like an act that created the beginning of the end, that it's almost Rome, the ultimate, you know, future enemy, is being created here through this marriage. So again, different ways to see kind of how this plays out. So on one hand, we see this with Bat Paro. Perhaps a charitable read, but perhaps also it could be something negative. And the second thing, as we're going kind of in order here, is Shlomo's request for wisdom. Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting that we don't really see Nevi'im with Shlomo. The question was, do we see Nevi'im with Shlomo kind of warning him about what to do? You know, that we see perhaps with other kings, they got kind of warnings. So interesting question. We don't see specifically Nevi'im, but God does appear to Shlomo twice, and at least throughout these narratives. And the first time is more, which we'll talk about now, is the request for wisdom. But the second time, God warns him. And he basically says, that was the beginning of Perek Tet. Why one might say also that Perek Tet might be the beginning, you know, that's when the downfall starts, because God is already warning Shlomo, if you want things to continue to be good, you have to follow in my ways. Almost kind of like a warning, perhaps things weren't going as well. But I'm sure there were Nevi'im around, but we're not told explicitly of any Nevi'im that have conversations, which is interesting. Yeah, right. Many Nevi'im also. David, right, had Nevi'im also. So essentially, when we think about this request for wisdom, I remember, you know, growing up as a kid and reading the story and learning about the story, you always think that the request for wisdom is something very positive, right? Because if we look at the text in source number 6, right, in Perek Gimel, the fact that Shlomo is asking for wisdom, right? So he's asking for wisdom. He's not asking for what? Right, he's not asking for money, he's not asking for riches, he's not asking perhaps for power. But if you look at the text, it's interesting that what exactly happens, and what is Shlomo's request? So in Pasuk Tet it says, V'natata l'avdecha lev shomeh lishvot adamcha lehavin bein tov l'ra, ki mi yuchal lishvot adamcha hakaved hazeh. Right, he's asking to distinguish between good and bad. Who else he needs this to be able to judge his people? And God responds in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ad v'yomer Elokim Aleph, And God basically responds, you know, God seems to be very pleased that Shlomo doesn't ask for these other things. And instead, Shlomo's going to get everything, right? You won't just get the wisdom, but I'll give you everything that you didn't ask for because I'm so happy you chose wisdom. So on one hand, that seems very positive. But at the same time, perhaps even here, we could see a darker side. So first of all, just the words, Lahavin Bein Tov L'Ra, that Shlomo asked for. So what does that remind us of when we hear Bein Tov L'Ra? Eitz Hadaat, right? Very good. So this idea of the Eitz Hadaat and Gan Eden of almost being something off limits that one shouldn't ask for, right? Which seems kind of surprising. So on one hand, perhaps already, as pointed out by different, again, Tanakh scholars, that perhaps this already is a hint that not all is well with this request of wisdom. Though again, you know, you definitely can view this in a very positive light as well, but just to show a different side, perhaps already the idea of Bein Tov L'Ra, you know, is hinting to us. And again, if I would have to list different things I would want a king to ask for, wisdom is a very positive thing, right? But what about perhaps Yirat Shamayim, right? There's other things that perhaps we would have wanted him to, or we would expect a king to ask for that might be a more positive request. If you turn the page over in source 7, there's a midrash in Shir HaShirim, which again also seems to paint this in a very interesting way. And it tells almost like an anecdote. And it says over here, it tells the story of an orphan who grew up in the palace of the king. I'll just read in the Hebrew, we can follow along in the English, right? Rav Simon b'shem Rav Shimon ben Chalakta, Levi Yatusha haya gadel beito shel melech. So there was an orphan who grew up in the house of the king. Amar le, ha-melech sha'al ma aten lecha. Amar hev liotus, im sha'al ani kesef ezahab, hu noten li. Avanim tovim margilot, hu noten li. Amar harini sha'al bito shel melech behakol beklal. Right, that like you have this orphan and the king offers him whatever he wants. And he says, listen, if I ask for riches, I'm only going to get riches. If I ask for precious stones, I'm only going to get precious stones. But if I ask for the king's daughter's hand in marriage, what am I going to get? I'm going to get everything. It's almost like there's the joke about like you get 3 wishes and what's the first wish you should ask for? You ask for more wishes, right? So like here also, perhaps this was something much more, you know, calculated, again, that Shlomo was doing. And this midrash doesn't seem to be, you know, seeing it in such a positive light and parallels it back to Shlomo, right? Amar Shlomo, Yimashol kesef hava vanim tovo to margilot hu noten li, ela hareini sho'el ta chokhma v'kol v'chlal, right? That like Shlomo's request for chokhma was really, he kind of wanted God to, he knew if he asked for this, God would kind of give him everything. And again, you know, this idea of at least paralleling in this midrash of Shlomo seeing himself perhaps as the son-in-law of God, you know, again, showing perhaps a little bit more of this hubris, which again, I think we'll talk about at the end, is important to a certain element for a king to have, to be able to rule his people. But again, seeing that perhaps even this request for wisdom wasn't so pristine. What's interesting also is we see what happens with this wisdom, you know, which Shlomo's judging of other people. On one hand, it obviously inspires a lot of admiration and people come from all over to hear Shlomo's wisdom. But at the same time, as they come to hear it, we'll actually skip down to sources 10 and 11, many people come from all over, right? But when they come, in source 11, in Melech HaMelech Perek Yud, it says, V'kol ha'aretz v'makshim v'pnei Shlomo l'shmor chachmato. That on one hand, you know, this wisdom is definitely bringing people to see Shlomo's kingdom, and by extension, it's creating a, you know, an Or LaGoyim moment or a Kiddush Hashem moment. But at the same time, every time someone comes to ask for wisdom, what are they doing? They're running their credit card, right? They're giving a donation. So that's positive. But at the same time, how exactly is this wisdom being used? Also a question. And the final thing I will bring up as we talk about this case, this example of wisdom, is right after Shlomo's request for wisdom, we're told the story of the Shtei Zonot, right? The two women who come forward, and you know, we don't know which baby, you know, one baby passed away and one baby's alive, and we don't know what to do with it, and he cuts the baby, you know, are we going to cut the baby in half or not? So on one hand, that story seems to be brought as a perfect example of Shlomo's wisdom. So on one hand, that could be seen as very positive. Nobody else could figure out this riddle. No one else could solve and bring out the truth and the mishpat in this case, only Shlomo. Rabbi Chaim Angel, who teaches Bible here at YU, he has a fascinating article where he talks about how perhaps it's a moral message as well, that like two zonot, two prostitutes who are on the lowest possible end of society, even they could get an audience before the king and they could have their case heard. And look at the tzedek u'mishpat that's going on in Shlomo's kingdom. So on one hand, something very positive. At the same time, it's interesting to think about that story in almost a different way. If you think about the idea that if you were standing in line to hear, you know, to have your case heard before Shlomo, and you're standing right after the case of the two zonot, and you see basically they come before it, and what does Shlomo do? He pulls out a sword. It's like, bring me the baby. You know, and if you see this happening, on one hand, you know, again, I think everyone was very impressed by this wisdom, but I feel like if I was next in line, I might be like, okay, someone else can go first. You know, a little bit of a hesitation that what exactly is happening, or what type of justice is this? You know, what is that? You know, almost like how exactly is this going to play out? And it's an interesting approach looking in source number 9. So Dr. Yoav Barzilai has an article in Megadim, a Tanakh publication, where he talks about this as well. And he says there's actually an interesting parallel between the story of the Shtei Zonot and the story of Akedat Yitzchak, both a textual parallel and also a thematic parallel. And in both these cases, we have a lot of similar words. In both of these, it's taking place, you know, Baboker, there's Bayikaf, there's this taking, Bayom HaShlishi. The idea of two people going together, what exactly is happening. In both these stories, you have a child saved from death at the last minute by a command from a higher power, right? The Malach, through, you know, or channeling like God, tells Abraham to stop, to stay his hand. At the same time, it looks like Shlomo's about, you know, we're about to cut the baby in half, but we pause. This killing of the child is really testing the parent's self-sacrifice, but there's a happy ending in both, right? The child is reunited with the parent. But at the same time, Dr. Barzilai points out that this perhaps could be a critique. This story could be a critique of Shlomo's wisdom, because again, over here, Akedat Yitzchak is in and of itself, right? A troubling narrative, but that at least is a test that comes from God. Here, Shlomo is almost doing something similar, but again, almost putting himself in that role of he is paralleling himself here to God, kind of in commanding that. So again, something that is, you know, kind of paints, I think, a darker light to this story. Like, is this something that is showing Shlomo's wisdom, or is it something that's more dramatic? Is it something that's more, you know, a scarier kind of aspect of Shlomo? Is it inspiring, you know, awe in the people, or is it inspiring fear in the people? And I think, again, and what is driving his request for wisdom? And where exactly is this request for wisdom going to lead? So again, we see things that are positive, but also things that could be already perhaps showing us the cracks in the kingdom, right? And the cracks that come out in Perek Gedalim. If we turn the page over, we'll look at a couple more examples. So next big thing in Shlomo's life is his building projects. As we said before, the most famous of those building projects is obviously the Beit HaMikdash. I think it's very positive. But also, it's not just the Beit HaMikdash that Shlomo builds. He builds his own palace. He builds a lot of royal buildings. The Beit Yar HaLevanon, which is also like a huge kind of royal building. He's going to build the Milo, which is kind of this filling between some of the buildings where Bat Paro is going to live. And again, looking at these building projects, how exactly, again, is this something that is seen as more positive, or again, something that already perhaps we can be more cautious of? So in source 12, we're told about the juxtaposition between his building of the palace and his building of the Beit HaMikdash. And we're told when it comes to the Beit HaMikdash, takes 7 years to build the Beit HaMikdash. But it takes him 13 years to build his palace. So the Mefarshim here are a little bit split. Rav Yitzchak Halevi has an article where he kind of talks about the pros and cons we can see from both sides. So on one end, we can try to, you know, throw this out again. What seems to be something positive, or is this positive or negative that it's 7 years for the Beit HaMikdash, but 13 years for his palace? How might we spin this? Yeah. For sure, right? Like, on one hand, so excellent, right? On one hand, we're told, right, that, you know, it seems to be that he built the Beit HaMikdash first, so maybe that's showing, you know, obviously, you know, his results, that he, this is something that he cares about more, right? But at the same time, if you think about effort, right, 7 years versus 13 years, it might be first, but it's... True, right, and we're talking about that next. But even, you know, with 7 years versus 13, he might have built the Beit HaMikdash first, but was it a rush job? You know, was it showing kind of that more of the emphasis was perhaps placed on the Beit HaMikdash? And if we actually look back just at the first chart, even just looking at what seems to be in the middle, right, when we talk about the, when we think about the idea of almost like a chiastic structure in Perek Vav, Zayin, Chet, first we have the Beit HaMikdash being built, then it talks about palace. It does come back to the Kelim in the Mikdash, and then the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. But again, it's almost like the the construction of the Beit HaMikdash brackets the construction of the palace. So does this seem to be that this was the focal point or not, right? And as people mentioned, the next source in source 13, just looking at the dimensions, right, of the Beit HaMikdash versus the palace, right, again, or the Beit Yar HaLevanon, some of the other royal buildings, they seem to almost, you know, the Beit HaMikdash seems to be much smaller in scale when it comes to, and again, even though the Beit HaMikdash, when we look at the dimensions, we look at the amount of kelim that Shlomo built, it was a huge, tremendous building, you know, much bigger than the Mishkan was, a tremendous amount of effort that Shlomo put into building it, but at the same time, the other royal buildings seem to be bigger, they seem to be built perhaps with a little bit more care. So again, things to think about. At the same time, we know that there's a very beautiful tefillah in Source 14 that Shlomo gives when he dedicates a Beit HaMikdash, saying that everyone should come here, it should be a place of prayer for all people. Seems to be, again, well, you know, one of the crowning achievements of Shlomo HaMelech. But again, how do we view this? It seems a little bit murkier, right? Because on one hand, we see that Shlomo is, again, creating, building the Beit HaMikdash and dedicating it, and obviously putting a lot of effort. And again, I think something that we've seen throughout, and we'll continue to see, that to build a functioning kingdom, you have to be able to function as a king. That on one hand, sometimes that means perhaps marrying people or creating treaties with people from foreign lands. At the same time, that might mean that you can't just have a beautiful, you know, religious building or religious institution and not have like a White House, right? Not have like a political center. Shlomo still needs to build a political center for the Jewish people and for Eretz Yisrael to be taken seriously amongst other people. If they're supposed to be this Or LaGoyim, you have to have a certain edifices, certain buildings that are going to bring people there. But at the same time, how exactly is this going to play out? And the Gemara in Shabbat in Source 15 actually also already kind of brings up this kind of darker side. And again, as we said before, the fact that Shlomo wants to build his palace close to the Beit HaMikdash, is that something that is positive? He wants to be close to Dvar Hashem. Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi talks about this in his article, that was this something that was positive, that you want to, you know, create or draw strength from the religious institution? Or is it also saying something almost about power? You know, like, this is the center of power, the palace is going to be next to this. And what exactly is that saying? So the Gemara in Shabbat actually, again, kind of paints Shlomo in a different light here. And it talks about what happened when Shlomo tried to bring the Kelim into the Beit HaMikdash. And it says, Keshebana Shlomo at Beit HaMikdash, Bikesh la'aknis aron lebeit kodshei ha-kodashim. And Shlomo tried to bring the Kelim in. And what happens? Dav kush arim zebezed. The gates locked. Amar Shlomo, Esrim ba'arba ranot velo na'ane. He starts praying, nothing happens. Patach ba'amar, and here it puts in some of the words from Tehillim to kind of play out what happened. Shlomo says, Se'u sha'arim roshechem v'inasu pitchei olam, v'yavo melech ha'kavod. Right? Open your, you know, open up gates and allow the melech ha'kavod to come in. Right? And the question here is going to be, right, who is the melech ha'kavod? Right? And now it plays back. And it says, Amrahatu batreilim valea, the gates kind of shake to almost swallow him. But Amru, mihu's the melech ha'kavod? Who is the melech ha'kavod that you are talking about? Amar lahu, Hashem izuz v'gibor. Right? Not me, don't worry. Right? It's God. God is the melech ha'kavod here. And finally, it's a little more singing of Su Sharim. And then finally, he is allowed in. But again, interesting hearing this Gemara, right, that even the Hava Mina, the first impression is that perhaps Shlomo would have thought that he was the Melech HaKavod. I think showing again that tying on where all this was building, where is it coming from? Yes. Right. Beautiful. Right, exactly. Thank you for sharing that. Right, that, like, you know, connecting it back to David and all of that history together. Right? Why is Shlomo the one who is building it through David? It's very nice. But again, I think seeing here already, you know, how exactly do we play this out? So I want to show a couple. We'll do, I think, one and a half more examples. We'll see. We'll look at taxation next, which is a big one. And one, when we think about Shlomo's kingdom and we think about taxation comes up all over the Sipurei Shlomo, all over the stories of Shlomo. And again, there seem to be different descriptions of a taxation that seem to kind of contradict one another. And we'll see if we can put them in order. And one, at some points, we're told that the taxation or the forced labor seems to just be on non-Jews. On the other hand, we seem to be told that no, it actually is Jews, but they go for a few months, and it's like, you know, they work for 2 months and they go home for a month, and it's not exactly forced labor. Then we also are told later on about Shivud Beit Yosef, that there's almost a specific specific type of tax labor force just on Beit Yosef that is used. And again, kind of unclear exactly how these are playing out. So what we'll see over here, though, is different. If is there a way to kind of put them together? And also, when we start hearing about forced labor or forced taxation, what exactly does this bring to mind? And what else do we see over here? Who exactly can Shlomo be parallel to? So on one end, if you look at source 16, we have here kind of the mas, the tax that Shlomo imposes. And just to give kind of to show some of the different words that we see here, it talks about the, well, actually we'll read it together, Zedvar Hamasa Sheherle Amel Shamolot Note Beit Hashem, Beit Beito, Beit Hamilo, Beit Chomot Yerushalayim, Beit Hatzor, Beit Gido, Beit Gezer. So all the garrison cities that Shlomo is creating, he needs help building it, Beit Kol Arei HaMiskanot Asher Hayu LeShlomo. That comes up in Pasuk Yotet. So when we think about Arei Miskanot, what comes to mind? Paro, right? And I think here it's interesting that, and we'll see a few more parallels later, that again, buildings have to be built. You need people to build buildings. That's how things worked. But at the same time, you know, was it too far? And we'll see how this contributes later on to the rebellion as well. So on one end, this first example that we're given, and we'll see the way to kind of put the taxation in order. One approach that's given, which I liked that I was researching things, was Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, talks about how even though the Prakim seem to be a little bit out of order, perhaps this is a way to make sense of the different examples of taxation that we're given. So the first one, which we just read in Source 16 in Perek Tet, talks here about kind of a first stage of taxation. It talks about when it came to building these garrison cities, who did Shlomo need? He needed people to do it. And it says that he basically used a non-Jewish labor force. Unclear if that makes it right, better or worse, but it says, "Vayelam Shlomo lamas oved, ubnei Yisrael lo natan Shlomo aved, ki hem anshei mechama ve'avda v'sarav v'sharishav v'sarei v'chbo parsham." That on one hand, it's all of kind of the people that the non-Jews who are living there that Shlomo puts into this mas oved, this workforce to build up these cities, but he does not take Jews from this. They serve kind of in a different capacity, perhaps as part of the military or in different settings. So on one hand, on one hand, it seems to begin, or seems to start, with Shlomo taking this forced labor force to build certain buildings, but at least at this point, he hasn't enslaved his own people. If you look at Source 17, then there seems to be a shift. Even though we're going back out of order, right, Perek Tet to Perek Hey, there then seems to be that Shlomo continues to build, right, things are going well in his kingdom. He needs more people to be able to continue building different things. Vayal amel Shlomo mas mikol Yisrael, vayhi amas shloshim alef ish. So now things kind of expand, and Shlomo is going to use a Jewish labor force, but they get to go home. Oh, it's not that you're completely always there, but there's shifts, right? You spend 1 month doing work in Lebanon, then 2 months at home. So again, there seems to be, as things kind of expand, as now we're building more things and Shlomo needs more work and more workers, he kind of expands it. But then, in Source 18, things seem to go to a new level. And what we're told here is now when it comes to building the Milo, and the Milo is going to be kind of the building between kind of like the palace and the Beit HaMikdash, where Shlomo is going to be putting Bat Paro, now he needs to have more people. And here it seems to be it says over here, right at the end, in Source 18, Ba'ifked oto lechol sevel Beit Yosef. That now, and this was interesting over here, is Shlomo appoints Yerobam, who we know later on is going to do what? It's going to lead the rebellion, right, and kind of create the civil war and tear apart Shvatim from Shlomo's kingdom. But over here, and now we've kind of shifted to Sevel Beit Yosef, where it's almost the house of Yosef, not the house of Yehuda, that seems to be put in under slavery. So again, I think here, again, kind of like a troubling aspect, but again, perhaps necessary aspect of Shlomo's rule, and one that you can debate. On one hand, buildings need to be built, and people need to be building them, but at the same time, who is Shlomo taking this workforce from, and at what point does it start to kind of hit a tipping point? And I think we see here with Yerobam that almost that on one hand, people were perhaps happy even to help build the Beit HaMikdash, or they at least saw this as a need, or to build the royal palaces. But when it comes to building the Milo, or the residence for Bat Paro, again, someone seen perhaps as a foreigner, this is when, and this is leading to, you know, when you're being taxed and you're being put into a labor force to build this, perhaps this is a breaking point. And what's interesting is to think about why is Yerovam, who's kind of in charge of this labor force of Beit Yosef, he is one of the people at the end who kind of leads this rebellion. You know, it's almost like enough is enough when it comes to the taxation, especially when they go to Shlomo's son later on and ask for a reprieve. And if you look at, in Surah 19, we see again, Achbat Paro al ta me'ir David al beta, asher banala az bana tamilo. And when Bab Paro is the one who's included in this, that's when, perhaps for some people, it's too much. And so if you turn the page over, I think we see here also that it's also different Rabbi Al-Kizron and a few other scholars point this out as well, the parallels between Shlomo and Paro. We spoke before about the Aramis Kanot. What's interesting also is later on, after Shlomo passes away, and the people go to Rehavam, his son, and they ask, right, for a reprieve. As we mentioned before, it says, "Ba'ata avi hamis aleichem ol kaved, v'ani yosif aleichem avi yasar etchem b'shotim, v'ani ayaser etchem ba'akbarim." Right, the famous line, you know, like you thought like my father was bad, I'm gonna be even worse, you know, or I'm gonna be even harsher on you. And again, this idea of, you know, flogging you with whips, again, seeing almost like this idea of a shivud, almost this idea of some sort of slavery. And again, something that's disturbing to see, you know, Shlomo paralleled again with Paro. So again, I think as we bring this kind of all together, we think about all the different examples that we saw. On one hand, I think we see that it's a necessary aspect here of Shlomo as a king, trying to do the best that he can for his people, trying to build different buildings. If you're trying to create an international center, you're going to need things to be built, and you're going to need a workforce. At the same time, was there kind of a darker element here? Was there, perhaps did Shlomo go too far when it came to enslaving the people, when it came to creating this workforce? Perhaps was the affluence that was going on in the kingdom at that time something that was able to sway him? Perhaps, you know, it started with Bad Paro and bringing in foreign influences, but where exactly were Shlomo's goals when it came to how exactly he was going to build the kingdom? And again, as we said before, just to bring the last example, Yerushalayim, in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, is an international center. It is a place where people come from all over to see the example of Tzedek U'Mishpat. Perhaps, again, painted as this utopian society. But at the same time, and we see this right in examples of Malkat Shva in Source 23, that she comes to hear everything and she's so impressed and she blesses the name of God, right, saying that seeing what a kingdom this is in a place of Tzedek U'Mishpat. But at the same time, perhaps has this gone too far? You know, where, at what point does the affluence lead to other examples? And to kind of bring all of this together and to kind of, you know, wrap this up, I think that we can see different kind of takeaways from these examples or from the life of Shlomo HaMelech. On one hand, as we saw, going back to right at the beginning, we saw that the way the stories are kind of written is that everything is amazing in Perek Gimel, and by Perek Yud Aleph, everything has kind of fallen apart. And why exactly is this written in such a stark contrast? So one explanation could be, as we know, Tanakh is not written historically. Tanakh is written theologically. And the theological message that we're perhaps to take out, or that the way that Sefer Melachim is written, is to show us that everything is good and is amazing until Shlomo does what? Until he sins, right? When he sins, when he brings in the foreign wives and everything falls apart in Perek Yud Aleph, that's when things kind of fall apart. That's showing kind of the consequences of Shlomo's sins. But as we saw, after doing a closer read, it's not that simple. Perhaps, again, that's the theological message, but the practical message could be that it's not just about the Avodah Zarah, perhaps it's about the Shivud, perhaps it's about the affluence. But again, I don't think these have to be mutually exclusive. The one, I think one of the greatest challenges of Shlomo's reign is perhaps the fact that they live in a time period of prosperity, and they live in a time period of affluence. And how is one to rule one's kingdom in such a time period? If you look at the final source, Source 24, this is also from Dr. Micha Goodman when he talks about this in his book, in Yeshayahu, it talks about this idea of Avodah Zarah, but it says that Avodah Zarah doesn't just have to be idols of clay or things that we make with our hands, but idolatry or Avodah Zarah can also be affluence. It also can be gold, silver. Again, many of the challenges that we see with Shlomo HaMelech, right? So in Source 24 in Yeshayahu, Perek Bet, by Timlei, Artso Kesef, Esahav, Ein Katzelo, Etzorotav, ותמלא ארצו סוסים ואינקצה למרותם, ותמלא ארצו אלילים למעשה ידיו ישתחוו לאשר עשו את צפותיו. That on one hand, they're almost parallel. That you can have the challenge of Avodah Zarah that Shlomo was led to right through the foreign wives of actual Avodah Zarah, but there also seems to be this challenge of affluence, of what happens when things are too prosperous. How many buildings are you going to build? On whose backs are you going to build them? On one hand, you need to build the Beit HaMikdash in a religious center, but there's also perhaps that challenge of going too far. So I think that perhaps we could see that these, again, the explicit sin and the implicit sin don't have to be mutually exclusive, and we can see the darker or the underside here to Shlomo's rule. At the same time, I think when we look at Shlomo's kingdom, on one hand, for sure, there's definitely these challenges, there's definitely the darker side perhaps of the wisdom, the darker side to the building of the buildings on whose backs they were built, the darker side even perhaps of the foreign women that are then brought in, the Avodah Zarah that takes place. But again, I think that this shouldn't take away from the fact that Shlomo HaMelech is trying to do the best that he can, as we said before, to rule his kingdom in that time. That on one hand, how does one balance trying to bring peace and prosperity to one's nation, but at the same time following the strict code, right, of what God wants from him? We see God appears to him twice, you know, warning him, explaining to him what he wants him to do, but Shlomo also has a challenge at his hands. You know, how is he going to create this kingdom? And the last thing, I gave you a map, or just the best version of the map I could find online, but Shlomo, and this is brought up by Dr. Avram Grossman, that he compares a little bit Shlomo to David HaMelech. That David HaMelech's way was, as we know, was milchama, was war. Not even in a negative way, but David tried to create, you know, peace or safety for his people through using the sword. Shlomo has the advantage of coming after David has, you know, waged many of these wars. But Shlomo works in a different way. Instead of trying to defeat his enemies in battle, Shlomo tries to appease his enemies through trade, through international relations, through political marriages, through political alliances. And again, Shlomo tries to use, as we see over here, the central location of Eretz Yisrael between different kingdoms to kind of use it as a center of trade, to use it as a center of wisdom, to try to use it as a place that can be an Or Lo Goyim, a place that exemplifies Tzedek U'Mishpat. But at the same time, as Shlomo kind of sets this up, the question is, he is trying to do this to bring peace and prosperity, but again, right, at what cost? What's going to happen when to build such a place and you're using affluence and you're using different methods that are going to help the people, but at the same time, how do we balance that with the challenges? So to bring everything together, and then I'm happy to take questions, on one end, I think that when we think about Shlomo HaMelech, we still should think of someone, you know, who tried to do the best he could for his kingdom. But ultimately, even though his kingdom reached one of the ultimate highs, the building of the Beit HaMikdash and prosperity, we also saw it at its lows, and we saw how it fell apart. And I think for us, when we think about, especially, I mentioned at the beginning, coming off of Purim, and I was thinking about this as hearing the Megillah, and we think about the way Ahasuerus and Haman play out different things, the way Esther and Mordechai play out in different things. How exactly are we to take these lessons of Shlomo to leadership of our own? How exactly do we deal with these challenges, perhaps not of war, but of peace and prosperity? How do we deal with the challenges of affluence, and how do we really bring everything together? So hopefully we'll take this in as we read through Sefer Melachim and we think about Shlomo again, how exactly we can learn from his challenges and try to direct our own leadership and our own way of dealing with the issue of affluence in our times in different ways. Thank you so much. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer at the end.